Hello and welcome to this Utility Week podcast. I'm Steve Hobson, editor of Utility Week, and I'm talking to Paul Leinster, who took over as chief executive of the Environment Agency in May 2008 about the agency's new water resources strategy.
Well, thank you, actually, first of all, for doing it. Well, I don't know if you want to just kick off and tell me a bit about the strategy, what's going to be in it, and how it fits in with the government's future water and the business plans which the companies are.
It's a strategy for England and Wales, right. And what we're. It's guidance and sort of an overall strategic view that the water companies should be taking into account when they're developing their water resource plans. We are charged with managing water resources in England and Wales, and therefore that we provide the context that individual water companies then use when they're developing their plans.
What are the key things you're looking for from them? As part of your strategy, I mean, does metering, for example, feature very strongly?
Yes, metering does. Yes. And what we would like to see is as near universal metering in water-stressed areas by 2015 or by 2020. You know, that it's as soon as possible we would like to see water metering in, because from our evidence, consumers who have meters use less water. Another key thing for us is making sure that there is sufficient water for people, so that's the supply side, but also for the environment, and that we don't over-abstract. So another key part of this is going to be making sure that there's a program of work which deals with unsustainable abstractions. Climate change is going to have a big impact in this. I mean, some of the work that we've already published, but will be part of this, is that by 2050, water flows in rivers, on average, will be reduced by 10 to 15%. In summer months, some of those flows are going to be reduced by 50 to 80%. Now, that's going to have an impact on when and how much you can abstract from those. Certainly within the southeast, we would also like to see some sharing of resources at a strategic at a strategic level, and within that, within the southeast corner, there's quite a few water supply companies as well as the major supply and treatment companies, and a number of them have put in additional resource requirements, and we'd like to see some strategic overview to make sure that the minimum amount of additional resources provided.
Well, I think we all accept demand management is important, but it's very difficult to guarantee it's going to actually be achieved.
Yes.
From their point of view, they're saying if we're going to guarantee water supplies meet demand, we need new resource. Do you accept that argument at all, or do you think demand management has to be delivered?
No, it's a twin-track approach. Right. And what you need to do is to provide additional resource, but you need to be deciding how much additional resource you need based on efficient, effective use of the material you've got. Yes. And I think one of the other things that comes into this for me as well is we now need to consider carbon within this. And a lot of the, if you take something like leakage, that's leakage of water that's just been highly treated.
Yes.
So there's a carbon cost within this as well that we now need to take account of much
more. Are you pleased to see that Thames Water have postponed the promotion of their reservoir? I mean, do you think in the long term we're going to need the reservoir, Abingdon?
If we have the housing growth which is predicted, then it is likely that at some time in the future there will be a need for another reservoir. Right. So it's not a matter of you don't need a reservoir. It's when is the appropriate time to provide one.
Yes. Do you think that you can encourage people to buy more water-efficient appliances and house builders to build rainwater recycling schemes simply by putting pressure on consumers, or do you need some sort of mandatory standards on the people who are actually making the products and building the homes?
I think the first way into it would have to be the voluntary way. And then with an underpinning, which is if people then don't move, then you need to bring forward some means of requiring them to do something. If you provide a signal sufficiently far out, then industry has the ability to adapt to that to then provide the, yes, the means. The incentive is for water companies to sell more water, and therefore you need to think of a different model, which is how do you incentivize the water companies to provide less but to be more profitable. And so there's this, you know, sort of how do you get the water companies being a service provider, yeah, not a commodity provider. Yeah. Depends whether or not you're driven by profit or by turnover.
Right.
I'm not quite sure how that works, but you know, when I ran a business, what you always had to guard against was chasing turnover and convincing people who were working for you that turnover actually wasn't the thing that you were,
no,
you wanted to maximise. It was your profit.
Yes.
The opportunity is that we are going to be building lots more houses. And as we build developments, how do we build into those developments which are more water efficient and resilient?
These building regulations, the answer there, isn't it?
It's one of the answers. But one of the things that I've challenged folks internally to think about is that if you were building a new village, what's the water supply and water treatment system that you would put into that new development? Now, we're going to have new development.
Yes.
So, you know, where do you use rainwater capture? How do you use suds? How do you make sure that you separate clean and dirty waters?
Yes.
How do you capture all your roof waters? And I think that there should be a whole lot of thinking going around that. And then think about how do you retrofit some of the more difficult areas.
Talking about, you know, PCC targets again, I mean, we've got a blanket 130 litres across,
yep,
the whole country. That seems crazy, where there are certain areas of the country where water stress is a far bigger issue than it is in, you know, Yorkshire and Northumbria.
I think it's what you're trying to do, though, is to get an overall shift. I mean, it would be interesting if they were to include within that some of the carbon costs, and you take into account climate change, and then decide where you are with that. So somehow we need to value water properly all the way through this process.
You also talk obviously about the current period where he's been doing it, and an exceptional period in terms of finances and the credit crunch and all the rest of it. The reality is obviously bills are going to be under incredible pressure. I mean,
yeah,
do you think there's going to be a lot of deferral of environmental schemes in the final business plans because everyone's so concerned about the credit crunch? And is that a concern that Ofwat might be tempted to bow to pressure? And
not from our discussions so far. No. We are encouraged that the schemes that we've put forward are going through. It's not only the new schemes. For us, there are a number of other important issues within this. One is making sure that the existing assets are well managed and maintained, because as soon as you start reducing capital maintenance,
yeah,
then we see more breakdowns, more pollution incidents. So therefore we've been pushing very strongly the capital maintenance and the operational,
yeah,
side, because we don't want to see,
no,
pollution incidents coming forward. Another area is making sure that the plants are resilient. Critical infrastructure. In the 2007 floods, then certainly sewage treatment plants got knocked out, the Mythe water treatment plant got impacted.
Yeah.
And the water companies need to have a look at those systems to make sure that, you know, during flooding events, which are going to increase,
yeah,
and a lot of these plants have to be in locations which are close to, you know, our own floodplains. So there is a real tension there.
Yes.
But to make sure that they're resilient, and the water companies also need to be talking to and liaising with the electricity supply companies, because it's no good if they, the substation that supplies them that goes down.
In a way, Ofwat, they're not very good at sort of allowing contingency funds. You know, well, it might, you know, the risk of flooding might increase from 1 in 100 to 1 in 10. And a lot of the water companies want to spend money on resilience,
yes,
improving resilience, and Ofwat,
yeah,
tend to turn around and go, well, it's your risk.
Well, I think one of the there's a good bit of work that we've done, and what I'm trying to do is to get this adopted as a model in the way that we work and in the way that others work. But on the Thames Estuary 2100 strategy, which is for flood risk management out to 2100, what we've done there is we've got a number of scenarios which will, against costed proposals, give you different levels of protection, right, depending on what climate change happens. Then, if you put in a monitoring system, then you can trigger the additional level of protection depending on whether or not predicted has happened. Right. If it happens faster, then you have to bring it, you know, your program forward faster. If it's happening more slowly, right, then you can push back. And I think that's how a number of people need to be working now in this whole adaptation area. Right. We are only predicting what will happen in climate change. And what we need to be able to do is have key measures, which might be average flow in a river if you're taking an abstraction from it. You monitor that, and then you have decision points depending on whether or not you're seeing lower flows or higher flows. Okay. I think that if people were building up their scenarios and their investment programs on that basis, then you could get off what to, you know, come in behind, okay, that, because you've got a rational approach, yeah, there, yeah, and it's not, you know, trust us, we think it's going to be, and then, yeah, it isn't, and somebody's, yeah, made a windfall.
Yeah. Why are you putting up your abstraction license fees by 10% to create a fighting fund, and what's the fighting fund for, and why should water companies pay for it?
It's all to do with dealing with unsustainable abstractions,
right,
and we need to address unsustainable abstractions, so there needs to be water for people and also for the environment. Some of the abstractions are unsustainable, mm-hmm, but if we are going to stop people abstracting as much as they were, then they need to be paid compensation. So what's happening is this money which is being raised will pay compensation for people to stop abstracting from those places. We've got water companies and non-water companies, and we're keeping those funds separate. So there's no cross-subsidy between the water companies and the non-water companies. Yep. If you have got an area and it's just a water company supplying or abstracting from that, then it is revenue neutral. The important thing is whether or not that water company can pass that cost on to the customers. And that need, you know, that bit is the bit that needs to be agreed.
Right. Okay.
And also it's to do with, for the water companies, we are looking to fund dealing with those unsustainable abstractions for Habitat Directive sites through the PR09 process, and for the non-habitat sites through this EIUC process.
Thank you very much for that.
Okay.